The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. I'm so excited to bring you this week's guest, the wonderful Frank DeCaro, writer, performer, pop culture encyclopedia. Frank was a role model for me back in the 90s when I would watch him on The Daily Show, and it was an absolute joy to geek out about pop culture with him and hear his disbelief that a weird little kid from Jersey got to grow up to have as many bonkers adventures as he has. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a quick thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon, including recent new members Sin Sage, Duffy, Brian, and Fairy Onion Rings. And if you like hearing about queer entertainment, check out my YouTube videos for dozens of deep dives into queer moments on TV and film that changed the world. I just posted a new video about hilarious old holiday commercials that prey on heterosexual insecurities and how commercials for queer folks are surprisingly different. Also, if you'd like to hang out with me, join me for regular live streams over at twitch.tv/mattbaum every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon for games and fun, friendly chit-chat. That's at twitch.tv/mattbaum. Now, here's Frank. Well, this week I'm speaking with writer and performer Frank DeCaro. He's the author of Drag, Combing Through the Big Wigs of Show Business, and A Boy Named Phyllis. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to finally be joining your podcast. And what an illustrious one it is. So I'm thrilled and I'm glad to be in the sewer with you. I'm thrilled.
Welcome. Sorry about the smell.
Oh, no, it's lovely. It makes me feel perfect. It's pandemic perfect, as we say. Wonderful. So it's great.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Oh, my God. The entertainment that changed my life and is still my idea of the funniest thing ever is when I first discovered the Munsters.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I found my TV family in the monstrous family living at 1313 Mockingbird Lane. And I so identified with them. I mean, my family didn't look like, my father was bald. He didn't look like the Frankenstein monster. And since my last name is DeCaro, I always fantasized that Yvonne DiCarlo was my mother. And my mother also had that, which as a little kid, I felt was that kind of exotic look, you know, with the dark eyes and the hair. She didn't have long raven hair. She had a, you know, Virginia Graham bouffant, but that was the 60s and that was my mom. But the whole thing where they thought they were normal and the rest of the world was weird, that was the feeling in our house. It was as if we were completely normal, even though we were as wacky as anyone could be. And I think that's what did it. But it's still my favorite entertainment. There's something about this suburban family of misfits that just felt like home and still does. It really makes me laugh.
So, you know, a casual outsider might be like, oh, the Munsters, it's just like, it's the Addams Family, but like the off-label Addams Family. But there's a lot more going on with them, right? Like, tell me about like what makes the Munsters special.
Well, the Addams Family was an aristocratic family, and there was a certain hauteur about the Addamses. They had lots of money. They didn't have to worry about that. Their eccentricity was really a blue blood kind of eccentricity. The Munsters were this sort of borscht belt all-American family, and that was really the difference. But I do love physical comedy. I love comedy that plays for a 5-year-old and a 55-year-old and can make both of you laugh. And, you know, they kind of were groundbreaking in a lot of ways. I mean, Herman gets hit by a bolt of electricity and wakes up his female alter ego. So I think he may be the first trans character on television. He wakes up with you know, barrel curls and sort of a granny kind of high collared outfit. And suddenly he goes off and becomes a cocktail waitress for part of the episode, which I love. I love the idea that the whole family, instead of freaking out, they're just like, don't let the customers get fresh. You know, that's kind of their take on it. And I thought that was very progressive. And they were the first couple to sleep in the same bed. I mean, they were monsters, but still, they were the first TV couple in a full-size bed.
I didn't know that.
Yes,
wow.
Herman and Lily are the first. But when I was a kid, my grandmother lived downstairs from us, and she would call that the dungeon because she watched it, the Munsters too. So it wasn't that kind of dungeon, but she would say, "I'm going down to the dungeon." So grandma, you know, grandma would play right along with my Munsters fantasy. So it's very near and dear to my heart. This is where you realize you're a complete nut bar. The moment you could download episodes to a portable device, And at this time, it was one of those iPods with the wheel on it, you know? And I downloaded my three favorite episodes of the Munsters. And my feeling was, if I was going to be in a plane crash and I heard it was going down, I could at least watch the Munsters while I was going. So that's why I always took my iPod with me. So I would have, at least I could be with my TV family while I was plummeting to Earth. Mm-hmm. So that's when you know you're a little bit nutty, you know, because it's, my husband always teases me because it's like, he thinks I make things up. And I was like, well, I do, but there's a logic. It might be specific only to me, but it's like, of course you need to be watching something that's very comforting while you're dying. So I should have these episodes always with me. So that was my idea. So it's thought out. It might be deranged, but it is thought out, you know?
You mentioned that your family, like you identified with them and you had kind of a wacky family, and we touched on the grandmother who lived in the basement, but not really that kind of a dungeon. What was it that was so unique about your family?
I don't know. I think sometimes you wonder, were they so unique or was it just your take on it? But it was really the story that I tell. You mentioned, thank heaven, my first book, A Boy Named Phyllis, which after 20 years out of print, it's on Audible now. And I got to finally read my memoir, which the advocate said, open the door for David Sedaris. So, you know, there you have it. So it's this sweet little memoir called A Boy Named Phyllis. And I talk about the Munsters in there. One of the chapters is At Home with the Munsters. And I think sometimes it's your own take on things. And as a little gay boy, particularly for me in the 60s and 70s, there was that feeling of being cast in the wrong play. You know, it's like you learned Hamlet and they're doing the out-of-towners, you know, or something, you know, and you're like, wait a minute, this isn't what I was supposed to be working on. And so you always felt like you were in the miscast in this role of little straight suburban boy who's supposed to like sports, and suddenly you're taking your G.I. Joes and introducing them to Big Jim, and you're both kind of snubbing Barbie, even though Barbie's the one you really want to be playing with, you know, and you're that kid. And I'm sure that still exists in some places, but there's so many more accepting parents now who are like, look, if the boy wants a Barbie, get him a Barbie. Which I worry about the collectibles business, because if all these little boys are getting Barbies when you're supposed to, what is that going to mean when, you know, I mean, are you... I mean, I check every day to see if the Elton John Barbie that came out about a month ago is back in stock because I didn't get it. And I was like,
oh, really? Elton John Barbie?
Yes. She's fabulous. She has a giant blonde afro and bell bottoms, and one leg says E and one leg says J on it. And of course, I have the David Bowie Barbie, but it's like, it didn't dawn on me they were it was a series, because then suddenly as a collector, I'm like, wait, I have to have all of them now, you know. But so I wasn't going to get Elton, and now, of course, it's my mission to find it for a decent price rather than the secondary market. But yeah, I think if a kid gets that when he's five, he may not need it when he's 55. You know, you'll have had your Barbie phase at the right moment. But
there's always going to be that nostalgia.
Yeah, definitely. But
so you're growing up this strange little kid in the 60s. What were your passions? Like, was it like Barbie, and what else was drawing you?
I loved television. I was the first kid. I was about 13 or 14, maybe 15 at the latest. But I was the only kid. And I would say this, I'm going to go out on a limb. I think I was the only 15-year-old in the state of New Jersey with his own Cuisinart. You know, I mean, they were new in America, you know. I mean, Julia Child had one, but you saw it on TV once in a while, but nobody had a Cuisinart. And I had one. That's what I wanted. I mean, other kids dream of, you know, I guess a Corvette or a Trans Am. I wanted a Cuisinart, and now I have two of them, so it's good. I was that weird little kid I laughed at things my parents thought weren't funny. I remember being little and having to explain Maud to them. I mean, B. Arthur would say things and they wouldn't get the joke. And I'd say, you know, they're going to do it on the kitchen table now. That's what they said about being impulsive because she's bipolar. And my parents would look at me like, who is this 13-year-old, you know, or whatever, who's, you know, and it was always, that's not what that is. I got a lot of, that's not what that is. Even though I was exactly right. You know, it was a lot of, you know, my precocious nature would get me in a little bit of trouble. But you know, we were Italian American, so we were colorful in that sense. It was loud, and it was there was lots of food everywhere, and screaming often. And if it got quiet, I always explain to WASPs, I say, you know, if you walk into an Italian house and the decibel level is through the roof, everything is fine. And if you go in and it's quiet, there's something's and somebody's in trouble. You know, it's like quiet is a problem. Loud is, there's no trouble. And I still am that way. I still argue with my husband. And then the moment later, he'll be mad and I'll be like, what do we fight about? I've got, you know, it's once I've screamed, it's finished. And I gravitated toward not adult entertainment sounds like porn. And there was that later on too. But adult entertainment in the sense that there wasn't so much niche marketing to kids. So, you know, you would, during the day, you would watch, you know, there were shows were like hosted by ventriloquists and things when I was really, really little. I mean, like 3 years old, but like mid 60s, you know, you'd watch Jerry Mahoney's Clubhouse, you know, and it would be this ridiculous ventriloquist on television. Paul Winchell was wonderful, actually. He was, I shouldn't say ridiculous ventriloquist. He was quite something. But anyway, but, you know, you'd watch these shows. This was before Sesame Street didn't arrive till I was like 7 or 8. So this is like local stuff and New York things. And I grew up in New Jersey and Wonderama. And you know, you'd watch that. But when night came around, there was only one TV and your parents set the agenda. So you're a little kid and you're 7 and you're watching Laugh-In or you're watching All in the Family and you're hearing words that now you never let a little kid hear probably. But you know, you're watching all of this classic television when it was new. And because it was what your parents watched. That was, it was a, you know, there was a lot to be said for three channels and group viewing because you all had something to talk about at the same time.
Yeah, and I think people think like, oh, well, kids aren't going to understand this. But it sounds like you were really absorbing it to a degree that your family around you might not have been aware of.
No, I you know, I mean, I grew up, the Munsters was hugely influential. I loved, as I said, I loved it. And I loved it because it was in black and white. I loved the look of it. My favorite movie is Young Frankenstein's, and you know, which Young Frankenstein, which is also a comedy, really. You know, I mean, it's a horror comedy. So there's something about replacing the scare with funny that's very much my personality, and a way of coping with being a scared little kid who's, you know, a little gay boy wondering what's going to happen and why am I so weird and everyone else gets, you know, is so normal, quote unquote. And that, and Batman was the other thing. And, you know, I mean, visually that mid 60s pop of color and Dutch angles and camp, I mean, it was so influential. I mean, I was, you know, I was on a camp drip from the time I was 5, you know, you know, watching an absurdly colorful TV, you know, and then Laugh-In was all quick take stuff and it was dirty, but not too. And you're shaped by all of that. I mean, I think there was a quote one time, I was reading an interview with Donatella Versace and she was asked about how her taste has changed over the years. And she said, I like what I've always liked. I just like more of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that hit me. Like, yes, that's it exactly. I like the same jokes I've always liked. I like the same colors I've always liked. I just like more stuff now because I know more stuff and I've experienced more stuff. But I think when you look at it, so much of who you are is shaped not only because you came out of the womb a little flamboyant little gay boy, but also because of the media that you were exposed to. And We all went to see 101 Dalmatians, but, you know, not everyone felt, you know, was like, that Cruella de Vil should have gotten that coat. She was fabulous, and look at how thin she is, and she's gorgeous, and, you know. I guess not everyone took it that way, but, you know, a lot of us little gay boys sitting watching 101 Dalmatians were like, I think she got robbed. I think she should get that coat.
So, and now, you were, like, close to New York just around the time of Stonewall and, like, going into the very exciting 70s, too, right? Like, was that your life?
Well, I was not cool enough. We went into the city when I was a teenager. I mean, you know, I would start to go in by myself. I was a really good student, so they would let me cut school once in a while, so I'd go see matinees. They didn't know I was going to see Richard Gere and Bent, you know. I could still tell you what that naked guy on stage right in the beginning looked like. I was like, I don't know whatever happened to him, but his name was Kai Wolf, and he had half a chubby, and I sat there going, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
yeah, show business for me.
Show business for, I love it. So no, I mean, we would go into the city. My folks were good about taking me to see Broadway shows, and that was a lot. And you know, I saw the Rockettes when I was really little, and you go to the Ice Capades, and which if you need a good camp injection, that, you know, anything on ice is, you know, Showgirls on Ice. This is great, you know. Not the movie Showgirls, but that would be pretty good too on ice, actually. But you know, I did go in, and the good thing about being an old fart is, you know, you're. And once in a while, I'm like, ask me who I saw in Evita. It's like, the original cast. Ask me who I saw, you know. And you can go through Sweeney Todd, Angela Lansbury, and Lynn Carrier. Who do you think I saw in it? You know, there was something to, you know, there is something to being a little bit older and having seen some of the stuff that just now is legendary. You know, the night I saw Evita with Patti LuPone and stuff, it was, I remember having a fight with my high school boyfriend. It's amazing. I was so, you know, you're so fraught as a teenager when you're, especially if you're having a gay affair with someone in high school.
It's so interesting to hear you say like high school boyfriend, because I think a lot of people missed out, like given the time, like did not have the freedom to date and or even be able to find other gay people openly. What was your little gay world like?
Oh, it was only this one guy really, but we were in geometry class. We were in coordinate geometry class and both were really good students and we kind of fell for each other and our gag, and this is all in a boy named Phyllis. Our shtick with each other was that I was Elton John and he was Rod Stewart. And so that was our thing, because he was this tall, willowy blonde and I was this, you know, I wasn't bald yet, but, but you know, I was the doughier half of that. Although I'd killed to weigh what I weighed when I thought I was doughy. Oh my God, it's like 100 pounds less than I am now, practically. And I was like, oh, am I fat? You know, I mean, you were 34. That's disgusting, you know. And it's, yeah, we're awful to ourselves, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But no, we met in class and we ended up having a love affair on and off for about a year. And then we went off to college and that was the end of it. But it wasn't the end of our story. I got a text from him the other day. You know, I mean, so we're still pals, you know. And, you know, we follow each other's husbands on Instagram and all that stuff. But it's nice. I'm of the mind that you don't stop loving someone you really loved. You know, it doesn't mean you want to move in with them or anything, but if you love them, there's a piece of your heart that belongs to them. And whoever's next or whoever, you know, my husband's spot is next to that. It's bigger and longer and more tempered, but you know, it's like when you get a new dog, you don't stop loving the dog that died. You know, you still love the other dog. You just don't focus on it as much. And, but I do, I think that's kind of a good thing it might be just lesbian. I don't know, but I do think keeping people in your life is a nice thing. And you know, there are the people that I don't stay in touch with, it kind of, there's a little piece of me that it breaks my heart that we didn't, at least, there are a couple friends who meant a lot to me that I don't know how to get in touch with. And I'm not sure they'd want me to. And that makes me sad, you know, because there are good ones from all, you know, close friendships from all stages of my life. I mean, I think of some newer friends and my newest friends are like 10 years now. And you know, so it's weird that you think of, you know, the second wave of friends and you've known them for 30 years. It's a weird thing.
Yeah, I have the same thing where every now and then on Facebook, I'll do a little search to be like, you know, this is the first person I came out to. I've always wanted to like talk to him about like, you know, I was 16 years old and I came out to this boy on the bus and I don't know what I was thinking, but I did. And we remain friends for a while and then, you know, drift apart. And I'm like, what was that like for you? Like, what was his experience of receiving that news from me? The first person I told, you know, every now and then I'll do the little search and they're just like somewhere out in the world, I assume, but not Facebook accessible.
Yeah. I don't know when there are people, I had one friend who really had a huge impact on my life. This is the only one anecdote that explains the whole thing. I got a phone call, first freshman new student week at Northwestern, 1980, saying, hi, I hear you have the same Rocky Horror poster on your wall that I do. Do you want to go see Iggy Pop downtown? And we went to Chicago. I opened the door and this crazed woman in punk rock gear, you know, I opened the door and we went to see Iggy Pop in a basement club. It was like in the basement of a house. He was tearing the acoustic ceiling tiles out and throwing them in the audience. I was like, you know, I may never have a girlfriend, but this broad and I are going to be joined at the hip. And we were for many years. But then when we drifted apart, It pains me that I don't, that, you know, I mean, I don't think she'd want me to get in touch with her, but I wish I knew how to, if I needed to, you know, it makes me just, I want to know they're doing all right. I don't want to be in their living room. I just want to know they're okay. Well, so
tell me about college. You went to, you said Northeastern.
Northwestern.
What was like, what were you going for? What were you looking for? Like getting away from the East Coast?
Yeah, it was, well, mostly it, I went there, and I'm not joking, and this is the gayest thing anyone's going to tell you, at least today. We had in, this is before we had, anyone had a laptop and all, it, none of that existed. The internet didn't exist. But I went to the guidance counselor, and I put in journalism, which was one, the writer part of me, and theater, which was the performer part of me, and what are the best schools? And Northwestern popped up on a dot matrix printer, you know, so zzz, 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 back and forth. And it said famous alumni, Paul Lind, and who was on the Hollywood Squares and in the original cast of Bye Bye Birdie. And I had done Bye Bye Birdie in the Paul Lind role of Harry McAfee senior year. And it was really the beginning of my life. It was when I got cast in the show. I had a boyfriend. I suddenly became popular after having been the nerd that got shoved in his locker and pushed around, you know, and called a fag every day. And sorry to trigger people, but that was the word every day, people. Suddenly, you know, my life began. So the moment I saw that he went there, I said, I'm going to Northwestern. Even though there are people who assume I'm a head trauma case, I was the valedictorian in high school. And I made me both, actually. But so my grades were exceptionally good. But in those days, you didn't have to have a million extracurricular things, because I would have been going to Rocky Horror, you know, buying Lucite heel disco shoes. You know, I mean, that was what I was doing in my high school. I was not volunteering to read to the blind. I was, you know, it was very self-absorbed, ridiculous teenage behavior. I had no extracurricular reason to go, but that wasn't such a big deal then. And I went to my interview and I got in, and so I didn't even have a safety school. And so I was like, well, I guess I'm going to Northwestern. And so I went, and I immediately fell in with a group of half a dozen not flamboyant necessarily, but for the time flamboyant gays. And I was suddenly, there we were, and we all were like, I don't want to be straight. Why is that better? I mean, that's kind of what we all had. We all had our issues, certainly, but none of us, I don't think any of us wished we were straight. It was just, that wasn't our thing. We were like, this is great. It's like, mm-hmm. one more way we're not like our stupid families. It's like, get me out of here. I'm never going back. And, you know, that was sort of the attitude in those days. It was, oh my God, when I hear young people moving back in with their parents now, I'm just like, I'd have killed myself if I had to move back in with my parents. It's like, you just didn't, that was failure. That was, you couldn't do that. You know, of course, it was economically feasible that you could, you know, now you're like, of course you move back in. Where are you going to get the money to not move back in? But then, you know, if rent was $300, you could, you know, a month, you could certainly scratch that up, you know. And I fell in with this group, and I'm still, you know, I mean, I can find all of them. I mean, those six of us. And the idea that we were so close to the generation lost to AIDS and yet managed to all be alive 40 years later. October would have been was when we all met 40 years ago. You know, we're lucky. We're very, very lucky that we kind of just were young enough to miss, you know, we were young and we didn't have any confidence. So we didn't sleep around, and that helped a lot. And just numerically speaking, not whore shaming at all. I don't mean it that way, but we just didn't, you know, we didn't have any confidence. So the numbers were in our favor, and we also knew enough about it early on and took safe sex seriously. And so we're all old and crabby and living all over the world. I mean, two of us are in Europe and the other four are here, and, you know, a couple in LA and one in New York. And we still can find each other when we need to, which is very comforting.
And it sounds like you were just like swimming in a lot of, like, you were talking before about like camp and gay culture and, you know, the Rocky Horror seems like it was a pretty foundational piece of everyone's media diet.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, we gave a party, and I don't know who came up with it, but it was a dead celebrity party. And so you had to go dressed as your favorite dead celebrity. And decades later, I did two volumes of the Dead Celebrity Cookbook. I had this I did these two cookbooks, and they sold all right. They were pretty fun. But it was based on that one silly party at Northwestern. And it ran the gamut from people dressed as Joan Crawford and Judy Garland to people dressed as Ernest Hemingway, Bojangles. I went as Yul Gibbons, who was a naturalist. Whatever is not a nudist. Is a naturist a nudist? Whichever isn't that.
I get that wrong too.
Yeah. He was the guy who said his line when I was a kid. He did commercials for grape nuts. And he said, many parts of a pine tree are edible. And then he would tell you about eating grape nuts. And so I went, he had recently died, so I went as him. But yeah, we were not afraid of obscure names then or now. We were, now people like that are all over Instagram, today we're celebrating Maria Ospenskaya's birthday in heaven, you know, and you're like, okay, good. The lady from the werewolf movie. Thank you. You know, we're all still in love with obscurity, but it was fun. And I mean, I think none of us ever thought we were going home. So we were like, what does it matter how gay we are? Do you know the actor Dennis O'Hare? He's been on American Horror Story. He is like an actor's actor. People adore him. He was the bald drag trans character on American Horror Story named, what was her name? Liz Taylor, I guess, was the character's name. We went to frat parties, new student, during Fraternity Rush Week. And we ended up dancing together, and we were like, I guess we're never getting invited to this frat, you know, and neither of us was asked to pledge, and it was no surprise, but we're still buddies. And, it's pretty funny to think how out we were then, but we didn't see it any other way. We were, I was not friends with tortured homosexuals. We were neurotic and we had our issues, but we didn't have issues about being gay. We all were like, this is swell.
Yeah, and it wasn't the boys in the band.
No, it was. Well, no, it kind of was the boys in the band, but less, not so tortured.
In happy times. It's when they're dancing, not when they're fighting.
Yes, exactly. But it's also, it's funny. I was reading some of the press surrounding the boys in the band, and I've seen it on stage a bunch of times, well, two or three times, including the version that was filmed for Netflix. And I saw the movie a bunch of times, and I've seen the Netflix movie, which I thought was terrific. Not surprisingly, because the stage show was so good. But I'm always like, oh, the original was better. You know, generally, I'll go into anything thinking the original was better. And I don't necessarily, I think you need to see the both of them. You know, I think there is, and I think that they were able to cast it with all those A-list out actors is a huge sign of progress. You know, that there are out A-list gay actors is a huge deal. But when I look at that, when I was reading about it, rather, I heard someone say, why would these people be friends? And I want to say, you don't realize, if somebody ticked the box, also gay, and your age, almost half the time they became your friend. You know, it's like, you just were friends with people because they were gay. And I'm not, I don't necessarily think that's bad, because you certainly had different points of view that now I don't think people do. If you can find, gay gamers who grew up in the 90s, you can find people who are exactly like you, some of the our group, we would give a kidney to either, any of us, we all look out for each other, but, some of them are crunchy granola types, and some of them are vodka gimlet types, and some, we're all buddies. Dennis and his husband have their favorite poem, and my husband and I have our favorite Laverne and Shirley episode, and yet we're still friends, so you kind of do get exposed to other kinds of folks. And we looked like what we used to say was a Benetton ad, because we really were diverse. I mean, we were Jewish and Italian and Chinese and African-American and Irish and Hawaiian. And, that was our little six group. That's a lot for six people to have all that going on, it just felt fun. And we're all still buddies, which is something I'm very proud of that. There's something about staying friends with your gay brothers and sisters that you kind of, we talk so much about your chosen family, but that's really what it was. We didn't have the words for it then, but that's what we were doing. And I'm sure people have always done that, but we were kind of the first generation to we're the first generation to get old and be out. Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, the generation before us died before they got to be old. And before that, nobody was really out. So it was, you know, not en masse. So we're kind of that first generation who can talk about being an old gay fart. And Lord knows we do.
Yeah, yeah. You're the first elders.
I guess. But we have so many people on whose shoulders we're standing on. But in terms of the out of being out, yeah, we're kind of there. We skipped. Well, I don't say we skipped the shame part, but we certainly managed to handle it and not let it ruin our lives, you know? Yeah. And that's kind of great. The big change to me was I was doing a talk to a Unitarian church, actually. And I always used to brag because I came out at 16, which was a lot in 1978 or 79. I mean, that was a big deal, 79. And this little kid raised his hand and I said, yes. And he said, you came out at 16. I said, yes. And he said, why did you wait so long? And that to me was like, oh my God, the world is different. Because it's like this little 13-year-old is giving me shit for not coming out as soon as he'd like me to. But, you know, 16 was pretty precocious back in the day. I mean, that was when people came out at 40, you know, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But after a marriage and three kids, you know, and we were just like, this is the best, let's be gay, you know.
I had something similar. Somebody described themselves as coming out later in life, and it turned out it was in college. And I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah, well, you know what? Good for that. That's better, actually. Yeah, but it's hilarious. Absolutely. Yeah. It's hilarious, but good for them for thinking that's later in life. That's like what we were talking about before, about the, you know, an old movie. You know, Indiana Jones is not an old movie. Okay? Mm-hmm. To Have and Have Not is an old movie. And maybe not even that, you know. Yeah. But
let's talk about like what happened like after college. So you've got this great support network, this great chosen family. What did you see as your trajectory? Like, where did you want to go from there?
I thought, well, I'm not going to, I don't think I ever really seriously wanted to be an actor because I didn't want to do the work of being a good actor. I just wanted to be a personality, mm-hmm. which I succeeded in doing on some levels. I took a job as a writer in Colorado at a newspaper, and I'd never been out of a big metro area. I used to think Chicago wasn't fast enough, and here I am in a tiny town in Colorado. And 9 months later, I got the hell out of there. And let me tell you, no one has ever moved to Detroit more happily than I did. I moved to Detroit, and I was like, you can see the air that you're breathing. You can, people cut you off on the road. It's like, it's tough. I loved it. And so I spent 3 years in Detroit and working at the newspaper there. I applied, I mean, this is how old it is now. I mean, God, I feel like it's ancient history. But I answered an ad, an editor and publisher for a fashion writing job. I wrote a funny letter, you know, to the editor. And that's how slow things moved in those days. You know, filling a job took months because you're writing longhand and, you know, or typing it up and sending it off and, you know, and waiting for a response. But I ended up getting flown in and interviewed. And during the interview, this was one of those life moments. The woman across from me, as I was interviewing to be a fashion writer, said, how do you feel about the faggot factor of your job? And I looked at her and she said, well, everyone's going to think you're gay if you take this job. And I said, well, I've never done typically boy things, so this is fine. I'm not worried about it. And that was the end of the question. But the idea that you can, in an official interview at one of the largest newspapers in the country in 1985, could be asked, how do you feel about the faggot factor of your job? Love that alliteration. And this woman was someone for whom the Tony Holm perm was the greatest invention since fire. Okay. She was not my favorite person. But I ended up doing that. And then that led to my moving to New York 3 years later, where I became a fashion writer for another newspaper, New York Newsday. And suddenly I was going to collections because the woman who was running the department didn't like to travel. And so I was in Paris, Milan, London. I'm 26 years old, and I'm on an expense account, and I'm flying all over the world, and I'm going to fashion shows, and I'm gossiping with Elton John backstage at Versace, and I'm meeting Gautier in Paris, and I'm shaking hands with Saint Laurent, and I was at Donatella Versace's apartment getting drunk with supermodels. I mean, it was a hell of a way to spend my late 20s. And then back in New York, I was hanging out with the in crowd, and it was pretty special, especially because I always feel like I was someone who should have sold shoes in a mall in New Jersey. I mean, that's what I was sort of fated to do, and suddenly here I'm off writing all this this stuff, and it's weird. You look at it, it's like, well, I've stayed in, you know, really good hotels for the last 30 years. Now you're suddenly just like, what the hell are we doing in this Red Roof Inn?
Yeah, you know, I was just...
When I was 30, I was at the Ritz. Yeah. What is this? You know, so...
I just watched the first two Superman movies again, and when you see, like, what a newspaper looked like in the 1980s, the giant lobby and the newsroom stretching forever and ever, you know, they're sending Lois Lane around the world. Obviously, it's just a movie, but still, like, that was plausibly a newspaper. It's just...
No, I remember, I came home in... it was probably early 90s, I guess. So this was more money than you'd think. But here I am, I'm barely 30 years old, and I came home with a $10,000 expense bill, and they only flagged that I'd bought batteries because I was supposed to have brought them for my tape recorder. You know, and they were like, you need to pay this, you know, $8 back. And I was like, okay. And so I took the $8 off, and then they gave me the $10,000 to pay off my American Express bill. You know, and I mean, that's what newspapers were like in those days. People spent money on things, and they paid you to do stuff. That mm-hmm. was the other thing. I mean, now, you know, you're lucky. Somewhere along the way, a zero fell off my paychecks, you know. Mm-hmm. And you do things now for hundreds of dollars that you would barely do for thousands, you know, 20 years ago. It's nuts. But, you know, we got our health. It's fine. Yeah. We're okay. You know, but it is an odd thing. But yeah, writing used to be a fairly lucrative thing, and so I got to do that. And also, it's funny because I hadn't really thought about this, but that led to my love of fashion, which led to writing a book about Bob Mackie, which I did, and the Dead Celebrity Party led to my Dead Celebrity Cookbooks. And being in New York in the late 80s and 90s and on from there, but I was there for that when drag was sort of coalescing, modern drag in terms of Wigstock and the Pyramid Club and the Boy Bar and the beginning of, you know, Charles Bush's career and Lipsinka and, you know, Lady Bunny and Head of Lettuce and all these people that we still talk about now, Varla Jean Merman eating spray cheese from a can, and, you know, and all this stuff was just sort of there for me to be drag hag number one, which is how it led me to my most recent book, The Drag Book, because I kind of was there. It was weird. The Rizzoli people asked me to do a book on drag, and I wasn't sure I was the right person to do it. And then the times I've been seriously in drag, you know, was like a few Halloweens and one web series I played someone's mother, you know, and it's not exactly a drag queen make. However, I was drag hag number one, and I got to see all this stuff firsthand. And, you know, I'd even seen Milton Berle live in a dress. You know, I was like, I guess I am qualified if I've seen Charles Pierce and Sylvester live and Jim Bailey live and seen everything Charles Bush has ever done and everything Lipsync has ever done. You know, that the kind of Joey Arias and, you know, on two continents, I kind of have been there for stuff. So I thought, yeah, I kind of am the right person to write a drag book. And RuPaul was a brunette when I met her, you know. I mean, she was in star booty mode way back in the day, and you already knew she was going to be a star. I'm telling you, I'd go to work the next day. We used to go to a thing called Rock and Roll Fag Bar, and it was a bald punk drag queen named Dean Johnson, who was a sex worker with a huge Johnson, but he was also a drag queen. And he was kind of a pioneer of queercore music, but he would throw these naughty, naughty parties. And you'd go, and, you know, I would run into a roommate from college. You'd run into Lady Bunny, and on a good Tuesday. And of course it was a Tuesday night, because in New York, nobody cool goes out on a Saturday or, you know, Friday or Saturday. So it was a Tuesday night in a neighborhood that in the late 80s, you were taking your life in your own hands to go to, you know, Avenue C and 2nd Street, way the hell over there before. Now it's the Rive Gauche, it's gorgeous. But then it was a war-torn Beirut, you know, and you were going to get killed. And we would all go, and you'd see RuPaul, and you got a, hey, baby, from RuPaul. And it was like, oh, my God, RuPaul said hello to me. And then that was what you talked about the next day at work. It was like, I saw Ru. So we all knew she was going to be a star even then. But, yeah, it's weird to have known these people for 30-some years. And, you know, what does Carol Channing say? Just lucky, I guess.
Yeah. So. Wow, amazing. And the like, what a world to be just, like, enmeshed in and to be in a position where you're writing about it. Like, you're sort of like the travel guide for an audience going into that world.
Well, that's honestly the you know, they always said Rosie O'Donnell was the ultimate fan, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, she wasn't necessarily supposed to be in the Broadway show, she was supposed to be, but she ended up doing it. I kind of feel very much a kindred spirit, because there is no good reason on paper that I should be drinking Dom Perignon with Linda Evangelista in Donatella Versace's apartment in Milan. There is no good reason for that. Okay. There is no way that a kid from suburban New Jersey who grew up with, you know, the most expensive thing my father ever bought was a used Cadillac Coupe de Ville, should be sitting in that room. But the secret is that, at least in those days, you know, it was a lot of the sort of the freaky kid was who was running things. So there were people who were not telling you where they were from, but they were the weirdo who came from nothing, who is sitting there now drinking the expensive champagne. I mean, I think what's colored everything I've done is that I am a fan of what I write about. I don't write pieces that slam things. I just sort of, my whole methodology is, oh, pay attention to this. It's really fun. You'll love this. You know, that is always my take on things. And also that I'm the least likely person to be doing this. I mean, I was a colorblind fashion editor. But, and I was good at it too. But it was, you know, I mean, that's not who's supposed to be doing that. You know, you're supposed to be living on vodka and cigarettes and, you know, and being, you know, turned sideways and disappear and have all your hair. And, you know, I was this bald, chunky little cuckoo bird, you know, who thought everything was funny.
What you're describing reminds me a lot of Truman Capote, being that person who's just like in the world and everyone wants him at the party because he's the funny raconteur and he's got all the good gossip. But there's also this sort of, I don't know, danger of like, oh, he's got all the good gossip on everybody else. What has he got on me? So, you know, it just seems like you're at the right place and at the right time to see all this great stuff.
Yeah, I was kind of blind to the negativity. I was like this, you know, goofball running around who thinks everything is wonderful. And I mean, I am such, even during the pandemic, I've been like a Pollyanna, you know, I mean, I'm kind of like, I got to watch all of Downton Abbey in 2 weeks. It's only 60 hours, hooray, you know. You know, there's butter getting to room temperature in my kitchen right now. You know, I'm going to go make cowboy cookies. It's like, that's what my days are like now. I refuse to give in to being absolutely miserable at this time. Mm. I refuse to see my feet at this point. But, you know, I mean,
it's well, like,
yeah, it's fattening. Oh, you're as thin as could be. Don't give me that. So what were you saying? I'm sorry.
What was it that got you out to Los Angeles?
I turned 50 and it was time to do something new. I am very much a person who believes in reinvention, although it gets harder as you get older, it truly does. But I felt like I had done New York. And so on the 25th anniversary to the day, I gave up my apartment and where my husband and I had been living. I mean, I'd been there 19 years and he'd been there for, I guess, 16 or 17 of those years. It just felt like, well, let's do something new. And I thought, you know, if I get one audition, that will be 100% increase over what I'm getting in New York. And I also, I was doing a radio show at the time and it was done from New York and Los Angeles. So suddenly we were just in the same room. So I could come out here with my job. And so for a few years, we did do that until they got rid of the whole channel, the whole gay channel on Sirius. It was kind of a soft landing. We knew enough people. But I do think it's good to kind of reinvent yourself and re-examine things and try something new and be a little bit scared and have a whole new chapter. I feel bad. I have a friend who said to me once, we can't all reinvent ourselves the way you can. And he was really mad at me for suggesting he do that. And I guess that's true for some people. I feel very lucky that I kind of can bloom where I'm planted and which I'm better now. I certainly wasn't good when I moved to Colorado that time.
Sure. Doesn't sound like it was the most fertile soil.
I spent a lot of time crying in the supply closet. It was, but I was also young, you know, I was 20. What was I?
Sure.
22 or 20,
you need a little crying.
Yeah, a little gay boy. And I wasn't out of the closet, even as fruity as I was. I still wasn't out of the closet. Yeah, it's weird. There's so many. I wasn't out in print until the week Clinton was inaugurated. That's when I came out in print. So it was 93, I think that was. But, and I'd been out since 79, but I not in print. And then suddenly you'd do interviews with fashion designers and dance around the question and stuff. But that's why I always like Versace. He came out in an interview to me and he said, it was kind of the I don't care who knows it kind of interview, which was rare in those days. It was something else. So
what keeps you busy now? Like you said, the channel went away.
No,
aside from Downton Abbey and cookies.
No. Downton Abbey and cookies. No, I've been, honestly, I am trying to sort of figure out what's next. I'm trying to sell a new book. I want to do a book. I haven't told anyone this. I want to do a book on the history of disco, but the phenomenon, not from the in-crowd perspective of, oh, I went to Studio 54, but from the perspective of those of us who got our disco at a teen disco in the suburbs, at an Arthur Murray lesson to do the hustle in Wisconsin, on the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, on an episode of The Jeffersons, and of course in movies like Thank God It's Friday and Saturday Night Fever, people who were part of that huge phenomenon that washed over the country in the late 70s, and then was sort of forced out of favor by the same impulses that gave rise to the MAGA movement. And, it was like, you gays and you blacks and you women are getting a little too big for your britches. And you need to be squashed because this is about white straight guys playing guitar, not disco,
Yeah.
And so look at it from that perspective and stuff. And also it's an excuse to write about the disco lunchbox and the Ethel Merman disco album, which I just found a vintage ad from one of the trade magazines, and it's Ethel Merman. It says, Donna Summer, eat your heart out.
Oh my God. I love it. I didn't know there was an Ethel Merman disco album.
Oh, you'll go out of your, you will do an entire take on, you will go out of your mind.
I'm so delighted.
I have it on vinyl. I have it on CD. I have it on my iPod. I have a digital. And you cannot get through listening to the whole thing. It's that horrifying. And yet, it's genius. Mm-hmm. But it's, you will lose your lunch. You'll go crazy. Well, is that the right? No, that means you'll throw up. You'll lose your shit. You'll just go crazy. It's deranged. But it's that kind of thing. I mean, I was watching a clip on YouTube from the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, and it's Alice the Maid and Rip Taylor singing Disco Duck. Okay, that is why I want to write a book. I don't need to tell the story. I mean, I will tell the story of, Bianca Jagger on the white horse at her birthday at Studio 54. Yeah, but I wasn't that person. I was the nut bar watching the Brady Bunch Variety Hour as a kid going, this is the best. It's Alice the Maid in a duck costume, So I hope to bring my own sort of weirdo take on it. But yeah, I keep finding things like, here's the disco episode of Starsky and Hutch. Here's the disco episode of Quantum Leap. Here's the disco episode of there really is a Jeffersons episode called Every Night Fever. George goes crazy and goes to the disco every night. And, it's hilarious to watch these things and how everybody jumped on that bandwagon. And so that's kind of what I want to do next. You start looking at least for me, I look at what had a huge impact on my life. And then I think, well, what hasn't been written about enough? And that's when I think of a book idea. I thought, disco kind of meant a lot to me. And the more I saw what that disco demolition night that kind of was the horror of the peak of the disco sucks movement, it was the same impulse. It really was. It was a MAGA rally, set to a disco beat. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And it was a white supremacist kind of event. Mm-hmm. And, they would deny that possibly, but that is You look at it now and it's like, oh, that's why disco had to die. It's because it wasn't about white guys, white straight guys, other than the Bee Gees. It was about, you know, women and gays and blacks. And, you know, I say in the proposal, I said in the right drag, Sylvester ticked all three boxes. Of course he was a threat, you know. Yeah, and also I think we reclaim gay history a little bit, and that's kind of what I want to do too, because this is, you know, you look at who were the early disco revivalists, in a way, but it was a lot of early out gay rock and new wave performers like Mark Almond, Jimmy Somerville, Pete Burns of Dead or Alive, right up through Sam Smith doing I Feel Love by Donna Summer, and it becomes the Target theme song last Christmas. I mean, you want to get, if you ever get depressed and you say things aren't moving fast enough, and I get that, RuPaul is the spokesperson for Old Navy's Christmas campaign. A black 60-year-old drag queen is the spokesperson for the most mainstream downscale store you can imagine, suburban store. It's like, if that's not progress for the gays, you know, it's like, you got to think about it. It's like, so you can get furious about our outgoing president, and you should be. But it's like, don't forget to look at the other stuff that has changed. It's like, what would a drag queen as a spokesperson when we were kids, do you realize what that would have done? How many lives would that have saved if that had been 1970 instead of in 2020, you know?
Yeah, get outraged, but also don't forget to listen to some disco.
Yeah, look at what's good. There's stuff. Look, I'm telling you, obviously, if you lost loved ones, this is a piece I'm writing, I got to turn it in an hour. It's been a hard time for a lot of people. But focus, the only way to get through it for me is to be the pandemic Pollyanna. It's like, I have got to focus on, well, I finally got to watch Downton Abbey. I finally got to read that stack of books on my nightstand. I cook every day now, and I love to cook, but I didn't cook dinner in my apartment for 19 years in New York. I mean, it's like, I wasn't quite keeping shoes in the oven, but it was close to that. You know, it was that Sex and the City kind of lifestyle. It's like, now I'm like, I can turn out a chicken with the best of them, you know? And there's always a homemade baked good lying around. It's like, so you do have to sort of look at that. And a lot of us, I love that meme where it says, I was playing to 20% capacity before it was cool. You know, a lot of us that were kind of underemployed to begin with, it's not that different. You know, it's just now you have more people to complain about your money situation to. You know, now you're like, oh, honey, I hear you. It's like, I couldn't afford that either. You know, and not constantly shopping. You know what? That's been kind of good for a year to have. I've had American Express bills that were in the low three digits. I used to be good for $3,000 a month, definitely. Now I got nothing, you know. But it's like, if you're not shopping, you know, for enjoying, you know, for no reason other than boredom, which so many of us were doing, you know, and we're lucky, you know. I mean, I'm speaking obviously from a place of privilege, but it's like, you kind of learn that all that recreational shopping was stupid, you know, and maybe we need to recalibrate stuff. When I talk to friends who want it to go back to the way it was, I don't want it to go back to I mean, I want to be able to go out in public without a mask and see theater and stuff, but I, you know. You ever see those memes that say, I'm still not hugging some of yous after all this? That's what I feel. It's like, I'm not going back to hugging you. I don't want to hug you. I like my life now.
Yeah. You know, there's some changes, that I think we can adjust our lives going forward when the horrors are over. We can be like, oh, well, you know, also it was nice to have some time just at home to bake stuff.
Yeah, just I think this revving at a slightly slower pace is not the worst. Of course, that said, meanwhile, you know, if 10 invitations come in, I'll be back and, you know, well, I'll be back at the gym first so I can get in all. I walk into my walk-in closet now and I say, this is where I keep all the clothes that I can't fit in. It's because there's nothing. I have like six pair, you know, I have a pair of jeans and three pair of sweatpants and that's what fits. Okay. My lower half, I feel like the Grimace. Okay. It's just, my ass is the size of a brewery horse. It's terrible, but it is what it is. You know, there'll be time for all of us to lose weight. But
you know what, or just enjoy what we've achieved in quarantine. I look at the what one might say is a lack of fitness as an achievement.
I had lost 100 pounds, and a lot of it, you know, found its way back. Not all of it, thank heaven, but more than I ever thought. I took all my stuff and all my double X's went to New Jersey. It's like I took it to, you know, and put it in storage and back east. And I just was like, oh my God, what am I going to, it's all my, I can't even go back and get pants that fit. But it's, you know, it is what it is. And but I feel bad for people who've truly had a tragic year, but I also feel there are a lot of people playing it for all it's worth. And it's sort of like, oh, come on. It's like, this was a glimpse of early retirement. This was not a glimpse of prison. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, stop acting. You know, there is no Disney Plus at Leavenworth. Okay. So quit your belly aching. It's like DoorDash brings you everything you want. So shut up. Okay. It's not that bad. You're in a gorgeous house or apartment. You're watching everything. Every entertainment thing that's ever been made is at your fingertips. It's like, so quit and put, save it for people who genuinely had an awful year. But I feel, don't you feel bad for people with children? Ugh. I mean, I'm one of those old school gays that I'm like, why would you want children? It's like, well, that was the free spin card. Why would you want children? Yeah. And, you know, I said, some people have toddlers. I have the Grace Jones memoir to get through. You know, it's not that, it's not as much work for me, actually, having to get through the pandemic. But, although that Grace Jones book was hard to get through. That was boring. Like, Grace, how could someone as interesting as you write a book this boring? But oh well.
Yeah.
Well, that should be my biggest complaint. You know?
Exactly. So if people want to follow along with the work that you're doing and check you out online, where should they go?
My favorite place to tell people to go, because I take it very seriously these days, is my Instagram account, which is @FrankDiCaroShow. I've been making these collages, and like the moment Rudy Giuliani started to bleed hair dye, you know, I immediately made a poster for Death in Venice with him as Gustav von Aschenbach, and you know, and then Tadzio next to him. So I'm always making these little collages that I put up that I think are pretty funny, and I take social media as sort of my the replacement for my radio show or whatever else I was doing. And so I'm trying to make a little mirth on social media and keep people giggling at least. Somebody wrote to me and said, your collages are getting more pervy every day. And I was looking at them and I was like, you know, you're right. They're dirty and pervy and funny, hopefully. And but I was like, yeah, I guess quarantine makes you a horny devil or something. I don't know.
Yep. Yes is the answer to that.
Oh, maybe I have to give some up to my husband. Maybe I, you know, because 24 years later, you're sort of, you know, take care of it yourself. I'll be in the other room. Yeah. You know, maybe I should give him a little something instead of just making collages. I should behave myself.
Incorporate that into the
thrill. I should give him a thrill once in a while, I guess. I don't know. I guess these cookies that I'm making today aren't going to be enough.
Yeah. Oh, well. Start there. Yeah, and make him earn it.
Yes, it's true. So, I would say @FrankDiCaroShow, or they can follow me on Facebook or Twitter is too mean. I mean, I post once in a while, but it's just too mean. Mm-hmm. But, and we'll figure out what's next. And if anyone's hiring, I'm free. Which everyone says, don't you feel that way? Hi, is anyone hiring? Yeah, I will do. There's a lot of stuff I can do. There's a few things I won't, but most stuff I will for, you know. What do they say? I'm not gay, but $20 is $20. That's good.
I quote Devin Green often, right? If it doesn't make me cry or bleed, I'll do it.
That's pretty good. Doesn't it feel good? And we're all in this together, people with me, you, and some better known, you know, better known than I am. But someone like Devin Green, it's like we're kind of all, you know, we're in the mirth making business. Smart division. That's hopefully it's like we're in the, you know, in the little more intelligent version of it, but it is sort of, watch this, like this, laugh at this.
Yeah. You'll feel better. Promise.
And promise me you'll get through this with me because I need you to be with me on the other side. I think that's my whole story. That's me in college. That's me with my high school boyfriend. That's me with my husband. It's like, stick with me and I'll see you, see you on the other side of any adversity. I have to say, I admire what you do very much, and I'm very honored to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I admire your work as well. I'm really, what a joy it has been to connect with you like this, because I feel like Honestly, we could continue. This could be a 5-hour podcast because we've barely scratched the surface of all the camp that I want to talk about.
Could I come back?
Would absolutely. I... absolutely.
Doesn't have to be that. Okay. It doesn't have to be that. Well, it could be tomorrow. No, I'm like, or the day after that, or the day after that. I have lots of days open
free.
Between now and the vaccine, I have a lot of days. So anyway.
All right. We'll fill it in with talk of old movies. That's perfect.
Fantastic.
Ideal.
And happy holidays to you too. It's the first time I've said that this year. So happy holidays.
Yay.
So.
You know what? Honestly, I haven't said it either. Happy holidays to you too. Yay.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness. That feels good.
Yeah. You too. Be well. Stay healthy. Look as adorable as always. And thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Same to you. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks to Frank for joining me. For my recommendation this week, definitely go looking for that Ethel Merman disco album that Frank mentioned. You will not be disappointed. And I also strongly encourage you to search for the Telly Savalas disco album. It is absolutely bonkers, and you'll listen with your jaw completely dropped. I personally associate disco with lewd dancing and bedroom assignations, so the idea of listening to this sultry, sexy music punctuated by Telly's decidedly unmusical voice is absolutely sending me. Thanks again for listening, and remember to check out my YouTube videos for fun tours of queer milestones from TV and film. Join me over on Twitch for live streams every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific. That's at twitch.tv/MattBaum. Thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.